We're live and we're local. This is a Juno Afternoon on Wednesday, January 24th, 2018. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. On today's show, we'll get a preview of the next production from Perseverance Theater, William Ink. We'll discuss upcoming screenings in the Buddhist Film Festival series. The next one's called One Mind. We'll talk with Wolfgang Buttress, the Wednesday night speaker for the Alaska Design Forum. That's tonight. And we'll get our weekly Eagle Crest update from Jeffra Clow. Those interviews, national native news, bird note, music, and more right here on a Juno Afternoon. And taking a look at weather today, widespread snow showers with snow accumulation around 1 inch and highs around 30. Tonight, more scattered snow showers, lows around 20. National Native News is next.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau recently traveled to a remote First Nation reserve in Ontario. In an open meeting, he talked about issues plaguing the community, such as water and housing. More from Dan Karpinchuk.
It was the type of open town hall meeting that Trudeau has become noted for, talking to people one-on-one and answering whatever questions they wanted to pose. He said his government is serious about working with local leaders to improve housing and water, issues facing dozens of First Nations across the country. The chief of the Pekangikum First Nation said there is a backlog of homes needed, nearly twice as many as when he became chief. He said in 2005 there were 1,800 band members, now there are 3,100. Trudeau said more and better housing on reserves is a federal government priority.
We know that unless you can start with safe, secure, adequate housing, it becomes difficult to succeed at anything else in life. It becomes difficult to go to school, difficult to work, difficult to raise a family right. It needs to start with housing, and that's why we are serious about working with this community and communities like it right across the country.
The chief said construction had become difficult because of the lack of electricity, so diesel generators were being used. Last year, the federal government said it would provide $60 million to connect Pekangikum to the power grid. On the issue of water, a boil water advisory has been in effect for parts of the community for more than 10 years. There is a water treatment plant, but most of the homes are not connected to it. Trudeau said his government plans to eliminate boil water advisories across the country entirely within 3 years. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
In recognition of Human Trafficking Awareness Month, Navajo Nation President Russell Begay signed a proclamation to address the issue across the reservation and in border towns. Jenny Monet reports.
At the start of a new winter legislative session, Navajo Nation President Russell Begay made it clear which issue sits high on the leadership's agenda.
So we just want to announce and proclaim the month of January as Human Trafficking Awareness Month.
Standing outside council chambers, Begay signed a proclamation declaring the month of January Human Trafficking Awareness Month on the Navajo Nation. In August, the president enacted a tribal council resolution to criminalize the sex slave trade from happening within the reservation borders.
Trafficking only happens in places like Asia or in Russia or Eastern Europe, places like that. But it does happen in the United States, and it does happen here on Navajo Nation.
While there are many advocates who push for the human trafficking resolution, it was Council Delegate Nathaniel Brown who formally introduced the measure in April. On this morning, Brown was among several who turned out to raise awareness about an issue that for the Navajo is lacking in any real discernible data and is also difficult to detect.
We have no resources on Navajo. The next thing we need to do, we would like to have all our Navajo Nation departments to be educated on what is human trafficking, where to call it, once they identify it, so we can begin to start saving our children.
The Navajo Nation represents the only federally recognized tribal government to amend its criminal codes to prosecute the international human trafficking trade in the tribal courts. For National Native News, I'm Jenny Monet, Window Rock, Arizona.
The San Francisco Board of Supervisors voted Tuesday to declare the second Monday in October as Indigenous Peoples Day. The city is following others across the country, choosing to recognize the contributions of Indigenous people instead of Christopher Columbus. Many Native people say the federal Columbus holiday represents genocide. The San Francisco Examiner reports the board voted 10-1 despite objections from some members of the Italian American community. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by the Heard Museum, hosting the 28th Annual Hoop Dance World Championship, where you can see more than 70 talented native hoop dancers vie for the championship title February 10th and 11th. Details at heard.org. Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members fight against poverty while earning money for college and gaining skills, with rewarding service opportunities around the country and info at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're tuned in to A Juno Afternoon, and I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. My first guests today are from Perseverance Theater, and they're here to talk about the upcoming production of William Ink. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Shelley.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for being here. So first of all, I would just like you to both please introduce yourselves and tell me what's your role in the production.
I'm Randy Reinholz. I'm an enrolled member of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. I have a theater company in Los Angeles called Native Voices at the Autry. We develop and produce new work by Native Americans. So we've been working with the folks at Perseverance and Art Roach, particularly the last few years, developing new work, some by Alaska Native writers. Last year we worked on They Don't Talk Back together, which was in Los Angeles in La Jolla and came up here. And this year we get to do William Ink. Really excited.
And how about you, Erica?
My name is Erica Stone. I am playing Cindy, William's wife, in the play. I've actually worked with Randy before at Native Voices. And a few years ago, I came here for the play Our Voices Will Be Heard. And I fell in love with the place, so I decided to stay. And now I'm doing another show with Perseverance, so I'm really excited.
You came up here for Our Voices Will Be Heard and you stayed?
Yes.
So you're a Junoite now?
I'm a Junoite, yes.
Oh, that's
2 years.
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, how wonderful. Well, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
All right, so William Ink is about an Alaska Native man who creates a Native corporation inside his head. Is this a one-man show?
Sounds like
obviously
it would be.
Obviously not, because Erica's in it, too.
I'm not playing William, so.
Who is playing William? Is that Frank?
Frank Katas, okay. Yes. Yeah.
Go on.
And then there are three people playing the board members, Aaron Tripp, Alec Shamas, and James Sullivan. And then Brian Westcott plays a couple of different characters in the play as well. So there's a bunch of us.
Good. Nice cast of characters. Mm-hmm. So as we mentioned, the corporation is inside his head. So how does that play out on stage?
Sure. So basically, William is a counselor, an Alaska Native guy. And his life is getting stressful, and he comes up with the idea that if he could manage his subconscious, it might help him with his addiction problems and make his life better. And why wouldn't he model it after Alaska Native Corporation? And as the corporate members get together, some are based on traditional Alaska Native folks and some are Western European psychoanalytical constructs. And so they start fighting to see who's going to win control of the assets of the corporation, being William.
And what motivated William, the character, to create a board of directors instead of just your basic, like, imaginary friend?
Well, yeah, actually, he references imaginary friends. And, you know, it's sort of like it's pedestrian, and he's so educated and, you know, he's so smart. Like a lot of us, that's where we get in trouble is when we think we know a lot. So he thinks he knows a lot, and the board gets the best of him. And, you know, it's funny. It's imaginative. There are times it's incredibly touching and soulful and then just wacky, silly fun. So laugh hard, cry a little bit, and enjoy the night.
What are the board members like on this board of directors?
Sure. There is a traditional woman, and she has a lot of traditional values that she's trying to impart on William. There is Joker, and he is the Raven trickster. I like him a lot. I like the character a lot. He's very silly at times, but he's also very serious, and he's very connected to sort of ancient ways, even though he doesn't always seem like that, and sort of tries to get his point across with humor. And then there is Shadow, and he's kind of our inner desires, just our ego, and the wanting sort of satisfaction right away.
American want on stage.
Instant gratification.
Exactly.
Now, the play is a comedy, even though it touches on some serious problems like substance abuse and alcoholism. Can you say more about that?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, as we look around us and we see people suffering with addiction and from the cycles of abuse, whether it's emotional, physical, or substance, and how do we break those cycles? So the question is in the play. That's why to write the play. How do people deal with those issues? And addiction is intergenerationally connected through trauma in Native communities. And, you know, it's easy to connect it back to contact and boarding school experiences that were incredibly difficult. It's surprising. I work in the lower 48 mostly, and a lot of people don't know about that. So at least Alaskans know more of their history, or at least have the opportunity to. And that's what the play is dealing with, is how do we get past these hurts? And, of course, humor is a big part of how we get past these hurts.
And the overall message of the play is pretty positive.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the idea that it's not insurmountable. It feels tough at different times, and sometimes it feels like he might not get through. That's a good story. But he does.
And the thing I really like about it is his way out is through connecting to his culture. And I think that's really positive. And a lot of times that's kind of left out of healing, especially out of addiction. But instead of pulling away from something like addiction, it's going towards something, which is learning about one's culture and being connected to community through that.
That sounds like a great message.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about the playwright, Lucas Rowley.
Lucas is a great guy. We met in 2010. A group was pulled together at the Alaska Native Heritage Center, and it was the Alaska Native Playwrights Project. And that went on for 3 years, and it was three different cohorts of about – it turned out about 25 people participated in the project. And Lucas was in the first cohort, and he's an exceptional writer. And his play, particularly this play, got the groups a lot of notoriety around the country. They got some funding together, and they formed Dark Winter Productions. So Lucas is one of the founders of that artist ensemble that's based in Anchorage. Great guy. He's a practicing therapist. So like he flew out on January 31st after our first week of rehearsals here and was at work that evening. So he's incredibly committed. He's very driven, like the guy in the play. And he's got a great sense of humor.
Yeah, he's amazing. I just met him last year during the workshop when we workshopped William Inc. And then this year we workshopped it again. Randy came up from Los Angeles and Rob Casely was our dramaturg. And it was amazing to me how quickly Lucas could take notes from them. And then if he needed to add a joke, he would just sit and think for a second. And then there would be a joke in the script a minute later. And it was an amazing process to be a part of and to see.
And that process also is infused by people like Erica and Aaron Tripp. The women's voices needed more support and to be more well-rounded, full characters rather than characters drawn by a man. And Lucas is a great listener, and so we have really dynamic. So even though traditional woman is on stage in her traditional regalia, she's incredibly contemporary and fun and a fast talker and really doesn't suffer fools and is – funny.
She's sassy.
Yeah.
And what does it mean to workshop a play? I've not really heard that term before.
We spend a lot of time. A play is something that takes place in front of an audience with live people presenting ideas. And that's really hard to do in your room by yourself looking at your computer. So writers need a process by which they bring the play out, show it to some folks, have some actors who are really good, read it quickly, because a lot of times that first impulse is what's on the page, an actor's first impulse. And the writer has to then decide, do I like what that impulse was or do I need to change the lines? It's very difficult to spend a lot of time telling actors, you know, you're really good at one thing, but I'm not sure you're good at these other things. You know, and you can kind of ruin their confidence that way.
Right.
So how do you lift them up through the writing?
Interesting. So you didn't really have a final product at that point in time.
No, the play. I mean, we're putting in changes tonight. We're putting in changes tomorrow.
That's showbiz. Huh?
It is a living, breathing play.
Exactly.
That's really cool. And then anytime I interview folks from the theater, I like to know what the set is like on the production. Can you describe it for me, please?
There's a tool used in therapy called a sand tray, and it is a zygote sounds. It's a tray with sand in it. And there are figurines that the person in the therapy would place in the tray. And then the therapist says – has questions about the figurines. And it can be everything from the people or – so that's the set. It's a sand tray. And it's really fascinating because then the actors are the figurines. And then they move through this space, and sometimes they move like actors, like people, and then sometimes they're figurines doing really silly things. And then behind it is this amazing backdrop. The play takes place on the Kenai Peninsula. So we're by the water looking at the mountains, and we're always in the presence of the grandeur that is Alaska. And sometimes we really feature that. And sometimes when the characters are very desperate, it's almost as if that goes away. And there's just the sadness of being in a house caught up with your own sadness. And then can you connect with what's beautiful and around you, the land? And this is the metaphor in this play.
And it's just stunning. I have several moments where I'm underneath the stage sort of waiting to come on, and there the backdrop is of Alaska mountains, and then there's sort of moving projections on it. And it is stunning. It looks like Alaska.
Alaska never fails to stun me. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Randy Reinholtz and Erica Stone. They're both from Perseverance Theater, representing Perseverance Theater and the new production, William Inc. When does the play open?
This Friday at 7:30.
And it's the world premiere of the production. It's its first run. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Is
it? Yes.
Okay. So, and that's one of the best things about Perseverance Theater, always showcasing local work and local artists and often premiering first runs of plays. So is there anything else new and exciting going on at Perseverance Theater that you'd like to mention?
Oh, there's always stuff going on at Perseverance Theater. After this, we have Cyrano de Bergerac. We are there's the Playwright Circle. I'm also the development director there, so I can speak to lots of other things are happening. The Playwright Circle is a development of mostly Alaska playwrights and mostly Native playwrights. There are five people that are in that are working throughout the year developing new plays. And Frank Katas is actually one of those people. So that's a project that we're really proud of and should bring more original Alaska work and original Native work, which is really great. We're also we've taken on a project called The Winter Bear, which is it's an advocacy play. It's geared towards children, elementary school and higher. And it also touches on some substance abuse issues and suicide. And that travels to communities throughout the state. We're going up into some of the smaller communities up in the Kotzebue area this year. So that's something that we're really proud of to be able to produce.
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
All right, so William Inc. opens Friday at Perseverance Theater, and is there a pay-as-you-can this week?
Yeah, pay-as-you-can tonight and tomorrow night.
Excellent.
So come see us, put those changes in.
All right, well, thank you both very much for being here, Erica Stone and Randy Reinholtz, and go see William Inc. Good luck with opening weekend.
Thanks, you
Shelley.
So much.
I know you think I'm a psychopath, Democrat lurking in the dark. This sucks, I'm the Kmart soldier, sorting trash. I kept the stash of Coca candy straight from Japan. Oh, my grandma, she was never as near. You know what I need to get by.
Something for your mind.
I'm a sociopath, my lovely prey. I'm
a cliche. Make way, I'm in my Pepsi mood. Mama needs food, how about a barbecue? For us, the bourgeoisie, so carefree. Remember when I don't know why you need to get by.
Something for your mind.
Support comes from the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, helping to reach educational savings goals. Save in Alaska. Study anywhere. Information at uacollegesavings.com.
The tobacco industry has led people to believe chewing tobacco is safe. They market their products to look like gum and mints and promote them in activities like baseball and hunting. The truth is, smokeless tobacco is addictive and causes oral, stomach, and pancreatic cancers. Don't be tricked by the tobacco industry. For free support quitting, call Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message is brought to you by the Partnership for a Tobacco-Free Southeast and Search.
It is about 22 minutes after the hour. You're tuned in to a Juno Afternoon, and I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. Here with me in the studio are Roman Modica, and I even practiced, and Nancy Simpson, here to talk about a film screening, among other offerings from the Juno Shambhala Center. Welcome to the show.
Thanks Shelley. Thank you. Good to be here. Welcome.
Roman and Nancy, how are each of you connected to the Juno Shambhala Center?
I'm a long-term member, been part of the center for 20 years. I had been on the council, and it looks like I'll come back on the council pretty soon. So, yeah, a very active member there.
And I've been a meditation instructor there for probably about 15 years and been involved with the center since way back in 1994, where I learned to meditate, and it was a life-changing experience for me, which helped me really feel like I wanted to help people with meditation as much as I can, which is one of the reasons we're here today.
Has the Shambhala Center been around since the 90s?
It has.
Wow, that's
Susan
awesome.
Chapman, who was she was a psychotherapist in Juneau, but she was also, she had moved here from Boulder, and she started the center with her husband, Jerry Chapman.
That's impressive. It's a pretty long legacy for establishment.
Yeah.
All right, so coming up this Saturday, which is January 27th, is the screening of the final film in the Buddhist Film Festival that's been ongoing for a few months here, and the center's sort of coordinated it. So tell us about this film, One Mind.
Right. This is a follow-up. We showed three films last fall, and we tried to squeeze this one in, but we were running up against the holiday period. So we're fortunate to be able to offer it this January. Last showings we had from the other films were really well attended. We had great turnouts for the first film was about Thich Nhat Hanh. The second one was about a nomadic group up in the Tibetan Plateau. And the third one was about the Dalai Lama. This fourth one is a very meditative, just an exquisite film about a Zen monastery in China that's been there in this fashion or similar fashion for over 1,000 years. So it's a glimpse into just being there with the monks on their farm and their community farm and seeing how they live.
I have to say, the poster for the movie alone is so beautiful. I could just feel my blood pressure dropping as I gaze at it. It looks like it's going to be just a beautiful film. So, and you mentioned some of the other films that were shown as part of the series. You mentioned they were pretty well received here in Juneau. So you expect a pretty good turnout on Saturday?
There's always a lot of competition, but we hope so. We hope people will come. This is a nice break from the chaos we're experiencing in the world today, just to come in and just watch this peaceful place for a while. And then after the film, we should mention it's screening at 4 o'clock at the Gold Town Nickelodeon, which is in the Emporium Mall. And then after the film, we're offering an open house up at our center, which is at the same building but on the second floor, and also an opportunity for guided meditation. So both of those opportunities will be offered after the film. So, yes, we're hoping for a good turnout. I think people will really enjoy this film.
Wonderful. So that's this Saturday, January 27th, 4 p.m. at the Goldtown Nickelodeon. Tickets are available at the door, and it's a pay-as-you-can event. That's
right.
Very Buddhist.
We hope for a donation between $10 and $20. With pay-as-you-can, students are half price.
Okay. Suggest a donation of between $10 and $20. Now, both of you also wanted to talk about some opportunities to explore meditation that the center is offering. What would you like to tell our listeners about?
Well, this Friday, at the doors are going to open at 5:15, actually, at the Juno Shambhala Center in the location that was just described. And there will be another opportunity for meditation instruction and some sitting for a while. And then after that, there will be kind of what we're calling happy hour, which will have some refreshments and just drop by. It's just one of those things to get to know the center and a way to be introduced to meditation. And then the support group is there. It'll be offered for 3 weeks, starting on February 4th at 3:30 at the center. I'll be running that, and Roman will be helping me on two of those occasions. I'm very interested in meditation and helping people get into it. And a lot of times people can learn they get the basic instructions, but it's actually very challenging. But as you said a moment ago, you felt your blood pressure dropping just in thinking about the film. You know, meditation is incredible for our nervous system. And I was a therapist in Juneau for 30 years, and I worked a lot with mind-body connection and helping people relax more into their bodies. And that's really, really what meditation is relaxing down into our bodies. But it's very challenging for us now because we're just very caught up in a lot of thinking, and particularly now we all have our phones and our different devices, and it's very hard to get a break from our conceptual thinking going on. And meditation is actually very soothing once you learn how to do it, and that's why I want to offer tools and support, because even if somebody's been maybe just gotten the instructions, or maybe they've been meditating for years, it's a great opportunity to come and get support for their practice and get questions answered and meet new people who are working with it.
That's great. Well, I love the idea of a support group to help learners get into it, and or to maybe help someone who has experience adjust their meditation methods, their strategies. Well, that's a great thing to offer. So tell me again, what are the details of the meditation support group?
The detail of the time and everything?
Time,
3:30,
place,
it starts February 4th at the Juneau Shambhala Center downtown, upstairs from Goldtown. It's near also the Rainforest Yoga on the same floor downtown. And you could come all three times or you could drop in. And also that's on the website for JunoShambhalaCenter.org.
Okay.
All the information's there. And we're asking for a donation of $10 or so. But, really, I really want to bring this to the community for whoever wants to feel this support and have questions answered. And I just think it's vital right now. All our nervous systems are probably flying a little high, and it's just so fantastic for your whole overall health.
Yes, you make a very good point. And even though meditation is healthy, I don't think we all carve out the time to do it. So
right.
I'm very glad the center is offering that. If you're just joining me, I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. This is a Juneau Afternoon. My guests in the studio are Roman Motika and Nancy Simpson. And they're talking about some of the offerings from the Juneau Shambhala Center. There's a film screening this Saturday at 4 p.m. at the Goldtown Nickelodeon, One Mind. And there's also a meditation happy hour coming up this Friday.
Friday.
And the meditation support group begins on February 4th. Is there anything else you two would like to add?
Well, you can come. The doors will open at 5:15 this Friday. And then there'll be meditation instruction again at 5:30. not again from 5:15, but from the support group. And then we'll have some refreshments and stuff if people want to drop by.
Meditate first, eat later.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. In winter, when snow blankets the northern states, nearly all of the beautiful songbirds that grace the days of summer are long gone. They're living out the cold months in warmer climes. But there's one special winter visitor that goes a long way to filling the absence left by the birds of summer. Picture a starling-sized bird with a swanky crest, a black mask, wings painted in red, yellow, black, and white, and a tail boldly tipped with yellow. This glamorous winter visitor is the Bohemian waxwing. When Bohemian waxwings appear on the scene, they arrive in flocks, often numbering in the hundreds. They roam the landscape in search of winter fruits, berries of mountain ash or juniper, rose hips, even unpicked apples. In autumn, departing their summer haunts in the boreal forest, waxwings wander south into the northern states and along the Rockies. Some years they venture even farther south. In fact, it's this itinerant life that earned them the name Bohemian, although the name seems equally well suited to their unconventional and exquisite appearance. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Today's show brought to you by Forterra, saving the places that are keystones of a sustainable future in the Pacific Northwest.
Support comes from Southeast Living Magazine, Southeast Alaska's home, real estate, and lifestyle magazine, working to reach potential home buyers and featuring articles and tips on home improvement. Available at locations throughout Southeast. More at seakliving.com.
Come hear how great composers from the concert stage and screen have reinterpreted Shakespeare's literary classics. Join me, Troy Quinn, and the Juno Symphony as we perform ravishingly beautiful music on January 27th and January 28th at JDHS. Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet Fantasy Overture promises to have you on your feet as the orchestra indulges in Nino Rota's iconic love theme, A Time for Us, as well as music from the movie Shakespeare in Love and Youth Solo Concerto Competition winner Kyle Farley Robinson. Tickets are at Hearthside, the Jack, JunoSymphony.org, and at the door.
You're tuned into a Juno afternoon. It's about half past the hour. And I was just playing some music from a group called Bee, and they are sort of the soundtrack to my next guest's work. I'm honored to welcome Wolfgang Buttress, the renowned artist and the guest lecturer for tonight's Alaska Design Forum. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
And Sean Boyle is here with me, too, to talk about the Alaska Design Forum.
Thank you.
So thanks for being on a Juno afternoon. Your work is really breathtaking, so it's very exciting for me to have the opportunity to speak with you today. And first of all, welcome to Alaska. You were saying this is your first visit here.
Yes, yeah, the first and hopefully the last. I think my first impression of Alaska was probably 1990, old TV series, Northern Exposure.
Oh, yeah.
So it was quite a while ago. And I know it's always seemed like quite a fascinating place, and even kind of coming into Juno, I didn't realize until yesterday that sort of Juno was completely cut off in terms of its own road system, which to me is a, it's an incredible thing. You don't get that in Europe. You can just get in a car and just drive. But to have almost this closed kind of little world, this little wilderness, it's an amazing and beautiful thing. But it makes it quite intimate, and maybe makes the people have been incredibly sort of friendly and open and welcoming. So we've had an absolutely delightful time.
That's great. I'm glad you got a good impression. Yeah, it is unique like that. And I hope you had a little bit of time. I know you got in this morning to take in the town and the scenery, as well as the arts and culture scene that our community is so proud of. And it's opportunities to interact with artists such as yourself that make our art scene so strong here in Juneau. So your most recent work, and perhaps the most well-known at this time, is called The Hive, and it is stunning. Can you please tell us the story of how it came about?
Yeah, so the sculpture, The Hive, it's a sculpture which is about 60 foot by, I'm trying to convert everything now from metric into imperial. It's 45 foot by 30 foot by 30 foot. And it was a centerpiece for the UK Pavilion for the World Expo in Milan in 2015. And the theme of that year's expo was Feeding the Planet. So it was an international competition, which I won with my team. And the theme was the bee, the plight of the honeybee. The honeybee is dying in unprecedented numbers because of climate change, pesticides, lack of biodiversity. And the bee is also responsible for 30% of all the food that we eat through pollination. So I wanted to tell the story, but express it as a multi-sensory experience. So the hive itself is actually connected to a real beehive. And inside the real beehive, we have these accelerometers, which measure vibrations. And these vibrations we then turn into digital signals. So the sculpture itself is, these signals get sent to the sculpture. And so whatever's happening in the beehive in real time is expressed as light and sound inside the sculpture. So the idea is that the audience, the visitor, has a real sense, a real empathy of possibly what it feels like to be inside a beehive. And so it's an ongoing dialogue, I suppose, between human and bee and nature. And it's the idea, I suppose, maybe to reconnect ourselves to ourselves and to nature. So it was in the centerpiece of the UK Pavilion, and it was pretty successful. It won Best in Show at the gold medal. And now it's in Kew Gardens in London, so it's the first pavilion ever to have a second life. It was going to be there for 2 years, and now it's a permanent feature, which is, we're really happy about. So it's a way to, to continue to tell this story through art, I think.
How does it feel to have that structure become permanent and to win the sculpture competition?
It was an amazing accolade. While we were kind of building it and designing it, we were kind of almost like in a bubble, really. We kind of thought we'd done something sort of special, but you never really know until it kind of goes out there. And when maybe about a week before it was opened, I was kind of terrified, to be honest, because there was nowhere to hide. All the world's press would be looking at it, and thankfully they were very kind. But it was it's an amazing thing, and for it to continue to have this second life is a really good thing. And I think one of the lovely and surprising things about the project is how it just continues to blossom. The piece of music that you played before, that's the soundscape to the sculpture, and that got released as a record, and then the bands and the musicians, we actually played some festivals. We played at Glastonbury Music Festival, say, for example. We had a live stream of the Bees, got streamed to the stage where we sort of played. So the idea that it's not just about art in terms of a piece of sort of sculpture, something physical. It's sound, and it's a way of engaging with a completely new audience, which is great.
That's amazing. I'm imagining now the hive and what it must have taken to install it and then move it. Did you have to take it all apart and reconstruct it again?
Yeah. And that was quite a thing. I mean, when I went to Milan, we had a year to design it, to do the detailed design and install it. And it's 170,000 different components. And we had to take it all down again and reinstall it in London. But we'd done it once before, so it was slightly easier. But I think with these projects, it's like in some ways there's an analogy you can kind of make with the beehive, in a way how people can kind of come together and create really incredible things, which are maybe better than you could ever do on your own. And it's very much like a hive in that way, you know. So we're not all individuals. When we kind of come together as a society and work together, you can do fantastic things. And I think the hive is testament to that.
That's a really nice sentiment. I really admire bees. I think they're a very inspirational animal, you know, the way their society is constructed, but mostly how they worship the queen.
But the queen has a pretty tough job, you know. It's incredibly important, but you know, she's kind of the slave to the hive as well. But the way everyone kind of works together, it's an incredible thing, you know, a really incredible thing. And I think something, you know, we can learn a lot from that. And I think in a way we can kind of learn a lot from nature. I mean, one of the things about the bee, I think, is you can almost see them as sentinels, because they're so exquisitely attuned to the environment. They've been around for like 120 million years. So you can see if the hive is suffering, we know that the planet is suffering. And in a way, I mean, here in Juneau itself, I mean, Sean very kindly took me to go and see the glacier this morning. And I must admit, it's probably one of the most beautiful things, you know, I've ever seen. It was incredible. It was quite grey this morning. But the actual ice itself had this incredible blue, aqua blue sort of striations coming through. And it was just mesmerizing. For me, it's had this power, this immense power, but kind of beauty. And we were talking before but apparently it's receded so much in the last 20, 30, 40 years, you know. In a way, it's a visual testament to maybe what's happening, I think, with global warming. It's really beautiful. It's a fantastic thing to look at, to witness. But when you kind of realize, you know, how much is melting and how it's kind of going, it's kind of sad.
Yeah, like the bees, the glaciers would be a great loss. They disappeared completely.
Completely.
But it is it's an inspirational sight to be at the Mininal Glacier. No matter how many times I see it, it never gets old. So I'm glad that you got the opportunity to see it.
Oh, it was amazing, absolutely amazing. It took my breath away, absolutely took my breath away. It was just almost brought tears to my eyes. I've never seen anything like it. It was incredible, absolutely incredible.
Well, I hope that imagery and that inspiration reappears in your next work. Because a lot of your work is based on natural elements or patterns, geometric patterns and things like that that appear in the natural world. The hive, I believe I saw something that looked like a pine cone and some other plant life. Can you talk a little bit about how did you become a creator of this type of art?
I'm 52 now. First, I went to art college and I set up a studio in my hometown in Nottingham in the centre of England. And I painted for quite a while before I made a sculpture, always played music. And I suppose I've always been really interested in nature. When I was a child, I lived in a large estate in the centre of England, in Birmingham, and then we moved as a family to Cumbria, to the north of England, to the Lake District. And I suppose for me, this transition from the city to the countryside had a real big impact on me. And it kind of really calmed me down, but at the same time, it kind of, I don't know, it connected me to myself, I think. And I suppose the more I started looking into nature, and especially the last few years I've been working with a lot of scientists, you start to see the patterns in nature which are repeated all the time in terms of, you know, Fibonacci, the golden section. And for a long while, I used to think that scientists and artists, we're at kind of polar opposites of what we're trying to do and achieve. But I've kind of come to realize that in a lot of ways we're trying to express similar things, you know, what it means to be, you know, a human on the planet, and express, you know, the wonder of the world and what it means, and to try and make sense of this beautiful and crazy world. And so for the last 10, 15 years, I've been working a lot with sort of scientists on a lot of these projects. Say, for example, the hive itself, you know, it wouldn't have been possible unless I was working with this incredible physicist, Dr. Martin Benchick. And so for me, when I work on some of these projects, they're 2 years, 3 years long. And what's really rewarding for me is I end up learning a lot about the world over those 2 or 3 years. I'm never repeating myself. So for me, it's an honor. And I kind of sort of think in some ways this whole thing about the bee, this tiny, small, little kind of creature. And if it wasn't for the bee, I wouldn't be sitting here in Juneau talking to yourselves on the other side of the world. So it's kind of really opened the world up to me, So it's a lovely thing.
Shout out to the bees.
Well, the bees are universal here in the world. We have our share of them on the side. And I have family who are beekeepers up in Homer. And,
really?
And it's really intriguing to hear you speaking of this piece that does cross the arts and sciences in such a way that is really gives you reason to think about our place in the world and how fragile it is around us. And that really ties to the Design Forum's lecture series title, Automata, which is trying to look at the how technology and the arts interface with and deliver message to the public and all.
The talk is tonight, the Alaska Design Forum, and you said this is the kickoff of the 25th season?
Correct, yes. Design Forum was established in 1992, and Wolfgang is we're honored to have you here as the first speaker of our 25th year in bringing artists and architects and designers and thinkers to Alaska to share with us, help us grow.
That's tonight at 6 p.m. at the APK right next door to KTOO Studios. I know you'll be sharing a lot of information with the attendees at that time, but can you give our listeners a preview of what you'll be talking about this evening?
Mainly I'll be talking primarily about the hive and about the ideas which informed it, how it's hopefully a harmony of art and architecture, science, music, how it brought these different elements and sort of practices together. I'll be talking about a few precedent works, how I've worked with astrophysicists in the past. And then hopefully at the end it will be like an open sort of discussion. Quite often I find in these sort of situations some of the most interesting things is the conversation at the end of the talk. And that can go anywhere. So, yeah, it'd be great if people want to kind of come down, listen to the talk. I'll be talking for maybe half an hour, 35 minutes, and then we could sit down and have a chat and a little drink afterwards, which would be lovely.
I do want to throw in that for those who didn't pick that up, this is at the State Museum, the Andrew P. Keshavarov Museum. Brand new building, brand new lecture hall, and it's also a first for us to have a presenter with our organization present there. So it should be pretty exciting, especially for anybody who hasn't seen the building yet. It's just gorgeous.
It is. I was just in there right before the show, actually, picking up a library book. So, yeah, if you haven't seen it yet, you'll be very impressed.
I'm looking forward to seeing it. I've heard a lot about it.
Yeah, it's new. It's recently, it's just been open about a year, and we all love it. It's fantastic. All right, so where can we find more information about the presentation tonight or the Alaska Design Forum? What's the best place to go?
So Design Forum has a website, and if you just type in Alaska Design Forum online, it'll get you to it. And within that website, you'll find history of the organization and a very, very lengthy list of presenters we've had in past seasons, as well as our current season. And I'm going to throw in on that for just a moment, because after Wolfgang is presenting here in January, we don't have another presenter until Daniel Ladner gets here in the first week of March. He's an architect from Switzerland. We have Skylar Tibbetts from MIT Self-Assembly Lab out of Cambridge coming in the last week of March. So there's two presenters in 1 month. And then in April, we have 10XTEN Studio, landscape architect out of Minneapolis. And, of course, I can share schedules and information on all of those presenters at tonight's show if anybody is curious.
Great, and I hope you'll bring all of those guests by a Juneau afternoon when they
get to
town.
Absolutely. This is kind of the highlight for us.
And for me. And I just want to kind of call our listeners' attention to your website, wolfgangbuttress.com. And if you go to that website /expo 2015, you can watch a short video that shows the hive from all different angles, which I do recommend because it is kind of hard to describe just using words. So I checked it out, and I hope our listeners do as well. So thank you both very much for being here today, and lots of luck tonight. I hope you have a great turnout. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Wolfgang?
Just to say that I'm just been so impressed with Alaska, and this, you know, this definitely won't be my last visit. I really kind of hope to come again. I really want to come back again in the summer and sort of see what it's like in the sort of summer and sort of see the two seasons. But what's been really interesting, I think, for me is just we've been to sort of three places: Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, and how they all have very different atmospheres. I mean, we were up in Fairbanks yesterday; it was -36 centigrade, you know. And it was just incredibly cold, but kind of fresh and kind of sort of vibrant. And so I'd really like to kind of go back there again. Sean was telling me about this incredible spas that they have up there.
Yeah, the Juneau Hot Springs.
And you can do that and actually experience the Northern Lights being in one of those spas. I mean, that just must be the most incredible thing. And then to come back here and...
It must feel like the tropics after Fairbanks.
Well, very much so. And it's come and see the whales. But even like a little thing, we were just down by the harbour earlier on, and there was this bald eagle, you know, sitting on top of this post. I've never seen like a bald eagle before. As a kid in the UK, you see a bald eagle and you see them as cartoons, almost like fantastical creatures. And to see kind of nature so kind of close and... it's just it's an incredible thing. So we've only been here 4 or 5 days, and it just we've done so much in it. I think we're going to have memories to last a long time. So thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you very much for being here. Wolfgang Buttress, the talk is tonight, 6 p.m. at the APK State Libraries and Museums. And Sean, thank you for being here as well.
Absolutely.
We're going to play you out with a song called The Hive, inspired by your work, The Hive, by B.
This is Ray Truel from Ketchikan's Ratfish Wranglers. We're thrilled to play our fishy style of rock and roll in Juneau for the America's Salmon Forest Celebration on Friday, February 2nd at the Jack. On Thursday evening, we'll record a special one-hour TV concert at 360. We hope you can join us for both. Cameras roll on Thursday, February 1st at 7 p.m. at 360 in the KTOO building. Admission is fish. Free.
You're tuned into a Juneau Afternoon. And with me in the studio is Jeff Reclau from Eagle Crest, here with our weekly Wednesday Eagle Crest update. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Shelley. And it's snowing.
I know.
I'm so excited.
It's all we've wanted.
Yes.
Every time you come in to talk, it's all we talk about. It's all we want.
Yep. So hopefully, you know, we're not going to scare it away. Hopefully Mother Nature has finally come around, and whatever deal she had going on, she's over it, and she'll just keep giving us the snow. So
yes.
That's our hope.
Yes. I hope she patched things up with Father Winter.
I hope
man
so.
Winter.
That's what we're hoping for. So, but at this point, it is snowing, and looks like there's more in the forecast. So we're pretty excited about it. So, and then just a couple things real quick. And this is, you know, we're coming up on our last weekend of January. So it's January is Learn to Ski and Snowboard Month. And we do have great conditions out there for learners. So if learning how to ski is on your list of things you want to do this winter, don't let the weather scare you away. We've got some great terrain out there and great conditions. So
what makes great conditions for learning how to ski?
Well, we have plenty of snow. We were able to make snow, and the snow is, you know, it's nice to have this fresh snow because it softens everything up, makes it a little bit easier to turn, glide on the snow. So that is really good. And we have, you know, we've got three runs running off of the Porcupine Lift. And so it's a good time to pick up the sport or get back into it.
Fantastic. Anything else you want to share?
Well, we've got, we're going on their 36th annual Learn to Ski Free Weekend. And this is sponsored by Mendenhall Auto Subaru. And they've been a longtime sponsor of this great weekend for youth ages or in grades 3, 4, and 5. And for first-time skiers, we ask them to put in an application. You can get an application online at skijuno.com. And if you're chosen, then you get a free weekend up at Eagle Crest. And it includes lessons and rentals and the equipment, transportation. It's one of our favorite events on the mountains. So just want to get the word out. You can find more information at skijuno.com. And application deadline is January 26th.
And that's in just a couple of days. That's Friday.
It is, yeah. And this weekend is made possible by a sponsorship with Mendenhall Auto Subaru, and we really appreciate their ongoing support of Eagle Crest and our Learn to Ski weekend.
Woo-hoo. Shout out to Mendenhall Auto Subaru.
Yes, they're great. And, you know, we've taught over 1,000 kids through this program how to learn how to ski, and many of them have gone on to be ski patrollers, snow sports instructors, and be involved in the industry. So it's a great program. If you're a third, fourth, or fifth grader, or you know somebody who's never skied before, here's a great opportunity for them. Find out all the information at skijuno.com.
Thanks, Jeffra. There's so many great opportunities to learn to ski, especially if you're a youngster here in Juneau.
Well,
A
lot of events, and you can find everything at skijuno.com. And don't let our weird winter scare you away if you've decided this is your winter, because we've got snow for you.
All right. Thanks, Jeffra. Anything else you want to add?
Nope. Just keep it snowing.
All right. And the Learn to Ski weekend is next weekend. What's the date again?
February 3rd and 4th.
February 3rd and 4th.
Applications are due January 26th.
Great. Thanks again. Okay. Enjoy the snow out there.
All right. Thank
I know you will. Thanks for tuning in today to Juno Afternoon. Tomorrow, Scott Burton will be back to host, and we'll talk with Sonia Nagorski and Laura Levis about the UAS Sustainability Club. Allison Holtkamp will be here to spotlight this weekend's Club Baby Seal performance. We'll talk with Heather Mitchell about this weekend's Juno Cabaret, and Nancy DeCherney will be here with Arts Up. That's tomorrow live at 3 on KTOO. Jeff Brown is the producer, and I'm your host, your Wednesday host, Shelley Delaney. Today's show will be available on demand online at ktoo.org. Until tomorrow, this has been a Juno Afternoon. Have a great Juno evening.